Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, the opera Fierce tells the story of four teenage girls facing the challenges of today's world. It's the work of Iowa composer William Menefield and librettist Sheila Williams, and will make its Iowa debut at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City this Friday. But first, Harry Oster was a folklorist and musicologist who dedicated his career to capturing folk music traditions of the United States. He recorded hours and hours of audio capturing traditional music and the voices of the artists who performed it. He spent a number of years at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge and recorded blues, Cajun dance music, African-American fiddle tunes, Creole Catholic hymns, New Orleans jazz, and so much more. He moved to Iowa in 1964 and taught for 30 years in the English department at the University of Iowa. His recordings and scholarship continued, and even though he retired in 1993 and passed away in 2001, his work endures and continues to inspire. In a few minutes, I'll talk with a couple of the members of the Swampland Jewels. They've just released their debut album. It's inspired by the work of Harry Oster. But with me now is Aaron Oster, a lecturer at Rutgers University and Harry Oster's son. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, how are you today?
Good, thank you so much for being here. And
my pleasure.
I tried to encompass just a little bit of the work that your father did, but can you really help me fill that out? Give me an idea of just really the breadth of the recordings that he was able to make.
I'm not sure that I can even begin. It's kind of overwhelming. He, between about 1956, when he went down to Louisiana State University, when he came up here around about 1964, as you said, he must have been pretty constantly out and about recording different kinds of music. There were, in my house growing up, there were literally hundreds of tapes, analog quarter-inch tapes down in our basement, organized in a system that only my father understood. And he had an encyclopedic memory of those recordings. He could look at a tape from 40 or 50 years earlier. And, you know, it might have had a few scratchy notes that had mostly faded out by the time he looked at it, but he knew what was on it, and he could get to, you know, a particular track or a particular time. There were, as you said in your intro, many, many different kinds of music that he recorded. He started off with Anglo and French ballads and extended pretty quickly then into various different African-American musical traditions, things that might be familiar like blues, and storytelling stuff as well. It wasn't just music. There were also a lot of folk tales that he recorded in that period, and it was a pretty intense... I don't know when he had time to do anything else, really. I mean, it's kind of staggering how much material he recorded in that period. And then when he came to Iowa, he continued to be involved in that world in helping to promote like concerts and, you know, lecture tours and things like that. I know he would bring, in Iowa, he would bring people to McBride Hall, or they would come to Hancher, and then they would, you know, somebody like Sunhouse, who's a, you know, Delta blues musician, would be, you know, would come in, would do a show at Hancher, which Harry would, of course, tape. And then he would also bring him into his classes to interview him and tell stories and things like that. And that went on and on. He also did some recording and investigation of Iowa folk traditions, like in the Czech community, I know, and among sort of what we call old-time musicians. He was instrumental in the founding of the Friends of Old-Time Music, which, you know, for decades ran, I think, called the Iowa Fiddler's Picnic. I think the first Sunday in October, I may be getting that wrong, out of the 4-H fairgrounds, where multiple generations of local musicians and people would come to perform their stuff in a kind of pretty free form, almost like an open mic that lasted all day, with jam sessions going on, small jam sessions going on in the parking lot pretty much nonstop the whole time. some of which when I was a kid and I was starting to learn guitar, I tried to participate in some of that as well, after having gone there for many, many years just as a, you know, as a spectator. And Harry would MC the whole thing. He'd be up at the mic introducing people and giving context for these different musicians from all around Iowa who would come and perform.
Wow. He must have been quite the community builder, because, I mean, we talked about the breadth and depth of the music that he recorded. He must have had to really be good at developing relationships with people to develop trust, so that this man who, you know, presumably a lot of musicians didn't know, could come into their home, come into their communities and record them.
Yeah, absolutely. He had, as a person, he had an amazing ability to, I don't know, just get people to trust him. He could, he was a, you know, incredibly smart, educated fellow from a the poorest of the poor immigrant urban Jewish background. He was a first generation American. And I don't know if that was a factor in it at all, but he could talk to anybody and they would talk to him. I mean, he had a rare ability to listen and to communicate with people. And he never talked down to anybody ever. And he could be a pretty heady guy. You know, he had a wide range of intellectual interests and academic background, and yet he always somehow could make people feel heard and appreciated, without ever in effect like dumbing himself down. Like, it was a really remarkable skill.
You talked about all of those reel-to-reels kept in the basement, and your dad kept a lot of that information in his head. So after he passed away, did it take a long time to really archive that collection?
Well, you know, I wasn't ultimately responsible for the archiving of that collection because there was too much going on. But after he died, for me, it was really important to just try to touch base with a lot of it, because he played, you know, certain things for me from time to time. Or he'd say, oh, wait, I've got something, you know, let me come back, let me play this recording for you. But there was so much of it I hadn't heard. And for a period of time, I really tried, as a way of kind of connecting with him and with his legacy, to listen to as much of that stuff as I could and transcribe some of it digitally just for my own, you know, so I could have it. But there was so much of it that it was really pretty overwhelming. And so I had some interaction with Chris Strachwitz at Arhuli Records, which was the record company that essentially bought out my father's independent record company, Folk Lyric, and had been releasing a lot of his stuff for a long time. And I kept sending tapes, you know, whenever I would come home from graduate school or whatever, I would listen to a bunch of tapes and send a few out there with some thoughts about what I heard on them. And a couple of those tracks ended up on compilations or things. But then eventually it just became too much. Like, there was so much going on, and it was pretty impressively disorganized, you know, things playing at different speeds on the same tape or going one direction on one of the two tracks and one direction on the other.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't just leave it. Yeah. I couldn't just leave it behind and, you know, step away for an hour and let it record. I had to actually like monitor it all. And after a while that became a bit too much. So eventually, and I don't remember exactly who contacted who, but eventually we had an archivist come out from Arhuli. They got some grant money from a couple of different sources to take the whole thing and eventually archive it, which they've and make it, you know, available digitally, which is what they've very recently done, which is really exciting. But yeah, at a point I sort of had to step away from it and hand it over to people who really knew what they were doing. But they didn't realize, I don't think, just how much there was. I talked to Chris Strachwitz there about once a year. He would call up. We'd have a nice conversation. He's quite a character. And I'm pretty sure that I told him that we had like hundreds of tapes in the basement. I don't think he really understood just how many there were until their archivist came out and they were carting them away. You know, I wasn't there, unfortunately, but they were carting them away by the barrel full, basically. And that, you know, looking at their website now about the archival project, they said something about over 800 tapes one way or another that they have, which is more than I thought there were, but in a way doesn't surprise me.
Wow. Well, I want to play just a little a tiny taste of the music that your dad recorded. This is a song from the album Angola Prisoners Blues. And in the 1950s, Harry Auster recorded a series of music performances by prisoners at Angola Prison, officially known as the Louisiana State Penitentiary. And many of the artists that he recorded were serving life sentences. This is now a part of the Smithsonian Folkways recordings. But let's listen to a little bit of Soldier's Plea.
Oh, and I heard soldiers sing, hey, darling mother, don't forget to pray. Just keep your lamp burning high in window till I return, till I come home.
That's just a recording of Clara Young singing Soldier's Plea. And it's impossible really to talk about all of the stuff that your dad did, but just very briefly, he was also a musician himself?
Yeah, after a fashion. He was more of an amateur musician. He did the sort of, the main thing that he did musically was that he would do like song and lecture tours about different folk traditions, which might include African-American songs and spirituals, which might include Cajun stuff, which might include British ballads, which might include Yiddish folk songs. He did programs on that. And so when he would do those sorts of programs, oftentimes it would just be him, and he would accompany himself on guitar, and he would, you know, provide context for a song, and then he'd sing the song and they'd talk about it some more. So that was kind of his main thing. And then he loved playing different musical instruments and working on them sort of as a hobby. So our house was and is full of different musical instruments of different kinds. He played the flute. He liked that. When I took up the cello in grade school, he took up the cello for a while. He played cello for a bit. And then, you know, pretty much anything else that caught his fancy, he would buy one or two or three or five of them and sort of try to learn to play it a little bit.
Wow.
But, you know, he was mainly a singer, and he could accompany himself on guitar. That was his main outlet.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Aaron Auster about his father, Harry Auster, a folklorist and musicologist. And this is a song from an album of Louisiana folk songs. This is sung by Harry Auster, Jambalaya, released in 1959. And this is Trois Jolis Dragons.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. So far this hour, we have been talking about the work and legacy of Harry Auster. He was a folklorist and musicologist who dedicated his career to capturing folk music traditions of the United States. He spent 30 years working in the English department at the University of Iowa. He recorded so much music and left behind this treasure trove of recordings. Many of them are now a part of the Smithsonian Folkways recordings. With me is Aaron Auster, his son, who's also a lecturer at Rutgers University. And I want to bring a couple of other people into the conversation now, because the Swampland Jewels is an Iowa City-based band. They just released their debut album, and it is inspired by the work of Harry Auster. It also features original music as well. And first, let's listen to just a little bit of Spanish Road.
My dearest mademoiselle, we were meant to meet in Midland, just off the Spanish Trail. Your papa, she won't like me. Hope your mama, she don't tell about a plan to meet in Midland, just off the Spanish Trail.
All right. That was just a little bit of the Swampland Jewels from their debut album. And Nate Basinger is here, front man for the group. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you here. And Forrest Husenfeld, drummer, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Nate, I want to start with you because I know that you and Aaron are friends and you knew Harry Oster when you were growing up. Can you tell me a little bit about that relationship, how that started?
Sure. I met Aaron at a music camp and we quickly became friends and made music and we started a band. And very quickly, I got to go to Aaron's house and meet Harry, and he had a very large impression on me. He was just a very welcoming person. He talked to me not as if I was a kid, but as if I was, not an adult, but as if I was somebody who, had something worth listening to. And he made me just feel very welcome, and very quickly started introducing me to music that I never would have heard growing up in a small town in Iowa.
All right. So even though you were hanging out with Aaron, you guys were making music, but he also became your teacher in some ways.
Yeah, very much so. Not only my teacher, he sold me my first accordion. So in some respects, he's responsible for sending me down this this dark path that I've gone down all these years.
So Aaron, what are your memories of that time?
So Nate and I met when I was, I think, a junior, probably heading into my senior year of high school, and it was probably like 14 or something at the time. And I'm pretty sure that there must have been a point where I was like, my dad was a folklorist and recorded a lot of like blues and Louisiana music or something. And he's like, oh, who's your dad? Like, well, let's meet him. So they had from what I recall, had a really great relationship over time. Nate, like Harry, has a gift for exploring and understanding esoteric musical styles, even as a, even when he was in junior high. And Harry was like this fountain of information for him. And later on, in college, Nate sort of went the musicology path. I don't know if that was your major or not, Nate, but I remember you spent a lot of time around that world. Now Nate is a person who's brilliant at finding stuff that nobody seems to know about, or very few people seem to know about. He brings it into his music all the time. And I think maybe some of that came from that sort of same instinct that Harry had way back when. But, that's my sense of it anyway.
Well, the serendipity of all of this is kind of overwhelming, Nate, just thinking about, connecting with another musician at school and then sort of falling into this treasure trove of music. I know you wanted to play a little bit of a song that you remember hearing because Harry played it for you. This is a song performed by Robert Pete Williams from the album When a Man Takes the Blues. So this was from an album of Harry Oster's field recordings. And this song is Train is Heaven Bound.
Lord, I'm with you. I woke up this morning with my ticket in my hand. I woke up this morning with my ticket in my hand. That train is coming, that's the train I ride. She's heaven bound. That train I'm riding, she's heaven bound.
And this is a song that you often played when you were in college and immediately after. I am curious a little bit about, all right, here you're this white kid who grew up in Iowa City, Iowa. And clearly you connected really deeply with this music. Tell me a little bit about that connection.
Yeah. Well, funny, this particular Robert Pete Williams song that you played, actually, I connected with it because it was about a train, quite frankly, and I was going through a phase where I was singing songs about trains. I grew up actually across the street from railroad tracks, so that song kind of appealed to me, and as we were preparing for this show, that song came to mind, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's a song Harry recorded, and of Robert Pete Williams, and I remember very clearly this record was reissued on Arhuli Records in the 90s, and Harry gave me a copy of it, actually. I think he had a small box of them, and was just giving them away, and I was like, oh great, you know, and that's where I discovered that song.
Wow. So, all right, I want to connect all of the dots here, because Swampland Jewels, you guys, both of you, Nate and Forrest, you are well-known musicians in the Iowa City area and well beyond. A lot of people know your work from Diplomats of Solid Sound and other groups. This album features original music, but it was inspired by Harry Oster's recording. So... Right. This was also a pandemic project, and it started with an accordion. So Nate, why don't you help us understand what happened here, the alchemy that led to this?
Well, I guess we could blame the pandemic. And so the pandemic, you know, made all of our worlds kind of go upside down. And my family, we relocated to Iowa City during the pandemic. And I spent a good portion of the pandemic practicing accordion, playing accordion, teaching accordion lessons, doing research on the accordion, interviewing musicians who play the accordion. So once the pandemic was sort of over and we were going out into the world again, I asked Forrest and some of my friends, I was like, hey, let's get together and let's do some playing. And I said, I've been spending a lot of time with accordion, so are you guys cool if we do some of these accordion songs? And lucky for me, they were cool with doing that, and so we started playing a lot of music that kind of came from the Gulf Coast region, French Louisiana.
So is it accurate to say Zydeco music?
Yeah, for sure. You know, corn-fed Zydeco, maybe, is what you could call it. It definitely... has a more of a Midwestern kind of element going on, but yeah.
All right, and Forrest, what was your reaction when Nate's like, let's start an accordion band?
Yeah, well, I believe Nate's exact words were, would you like to join a non-ironic accordion band with me, or start a non-ironic accordion band or something like that? And then I just immediately thought, well, I grew up in the Amana colonies. This was probably inevitable that I'm going to wind up in an accordion band at some point.
Although I'm guessing you probably heard a lot more polka than Zydeco music when you were growing up.
Yeah, definitely in the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s is what I can remember. A lot of the restaurants would blare polka music 24/7 pretty much. And so when Nate asked me to do this and then he came over and then started playing the stuff, it kind of brought me back to my childhood. But I discovered that it was a lot more rhythmically interesting. And I love a good polka, don't get me wrong. But from the drummer's perspective, it's
you
a little...
You kind of know where it's going.
Yeah, it's a bit monotonous. And so this accordion music that Nate was writing and revisiting, old classics that nobody really knows who wrote to begin with, were heavily influenced rhythmically by Caribbean music. And that song that you played, Spanish Road, he actually asked me to make a little demo of the beat that I was doing, and I did it on a plane ride on my iPad to New York City. And when I sent it to him when I arrived, he was like, what do you even call this beat? And I was like, honestly, I have no idea. I'm like crossing the Cascada pattern with a big three West African thing, and it's kind of unlike anything that I've ever heard or had to play on drums before, but it was still very familiar. And then you put an accordion behind it, and it's like it brings it back to my childhood in a way.
And had you ever played Zydeco music before?
No, but growing up in the Amana colonies in the 90s, they had a big Zydeco fest. And so I remember going there as a kid, and I loved it because you could eat alligator and there'd be dudes walking around with like a hook for a hand and eye patches and stuff. And it was just wildly entertaining as a kid. And the music was awesome. They always had Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Chas as the headliner. And so so it's weird because, you know, during the regular Amana weekends and stuff, you'd be hearing the polka music, learning from the restaurants. And then one week a year would be this big Zydeco Fest. And so, no, I'd never played it before, but I'd certainly heard it, and I had nothing but fun memories of that music.
Well, and you know, you guys have been into so many different projects and done so many different kinds of music over the years. I realize that Zydeco is not the only thing you do, but I mean, Nate, it seems fascinating to me that you would dive into this headfirst like you have. Why?
Well, somebody has to do it, and I thought I would take one for the team. No, I don't know. It's just something that has always spoke to me, and for years and years and years, I was like, I'm gonna learn how to play. You know, I'm gonna get more into this tradition. I'm gonna learn more about this, and then the pandemic came around, and I was like, well, I have the time now. I'm not out playing gigs every night of the week, and so that's when I was like, I've really made an effort to reach out to other musicians who are also playing into this genre, and connect with them and be like, hey, we're not working. Can I take lessons from you online? Can you show me how to do something? Can you teach me some songs? And it was a really great thing to do during the pandemic because it really kind of kept your sanity because you really felt you were learning something new and working towards something. And that's really kind of that was the impetus, was sort of the, you know, I had the time.
It's not your cultural heritage.
No.
I mean, how have you connected with the heritage that it represents?
I'm definitely an outsider, and I would never claim to be someone who's within that tradition. I'm definitely an observer, a visitor, a guest, I guess, like, for me, what as an outsider, what I find really interesting is just the different ways in which folks of these traditions that play accordion, how they can actually represent themselves in, like, different aspects of their identity, not just by the songs that they play, but even the choice of the accordion that they're playing, whether it's a button accordion or a piano accordion, the way it's tuned, all these different things. You can really dive into it, and you can kind of like get nerdy about it. But really, it's like the instrument itself can be this very strong kind of like cultural object in which like folks are using it to express, you know, like all these different kind of complicated aspects of their identity.
And Aaron, I want to go back to you. I mean, your dad in collecting and preserving the folk traditions in the United States, he taught so many students about these different traditions. I know there could be some criticism about cultural appropriation, but this is also, he made it possible to, was one of the people that made it possible to really carry these traditions forward and inspire traditions, new traditions and new work and new music today. How do you feel about seeing that connection from the work that your dad did to this moment?
Well, I'm certainly very, very proud of that. I'm also sort of amazed. I mean, I don't think I would say that he and his generation of folklorists, they were looking at a period where, you know, they saw that, some of these traditions that were indigenous to the United States, maybe were getting, you know, in different communities with different backgrounds. You know, there's always been cultural crosstalk between different communities, but not necessarily a mass media crosstalk. And that was something that happened and started to happen in Harry's lifetime. And I think that they really felt like they were trying to preserve some, you know, some of these traditions before they kind of got sucked up and absorbed into mass American culture, you know, which is a natural process, right? But
right,
they just wanted to make sure there was a snapshot, if you like. And so I've been tickled, you know, over years to see how, and I hear this sometimes from musicians that I, you know, hear about, like Cajun revivalist musicians or even blues musicians, like Chicago musicians, like, you know, second, third generation musicians. And periodically I hear these anecdotes about, like, oh yeah, I met Harry at whatever, and you know, we talked about the connection between Anglo folk ballads and you know, black blues songs or something, and those things keep happening. So I think it's had a wider impact than he probably imagined. I think he liked the music and he thought it was significant. He kind of got it out there. I don't I think he was always really pleased and tickled that these, you know, musicians would pick it up, you know, later, like people who were learning about their own culture a couple of generations removed from the people who were making the music. They wanted to get back to that. That happened certainly with some of the Cajun, young Cajun musicians that were coming up in the 1960s and 70s. And some of his recordings were their source material.
So the ripple effects just continue and continue. And unfortunately, we are out of time. But Aaron Oster, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nate Basinger and Forrest Huzenfeld, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And the Swampland Jewels has just released their debut album. They're playing a lot these days, probably getting a lot of people up and dancing, too. They'll be at MyFest at the Amana Colonies on May 4th, playing at 2:30. Then they'll be at Club 76 in North Liberty on Sunday, May 5th. You can find out about their shows and the music at swamplandjewels.com. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. The opera, Fierce, tells the story of four teenage girls facing the challenges of today's world. It was commissioned by the Cincinnati Opera, and the world premiere was in Cincinnati in 2022. Fierce is the result of a collaboration between novelist Sheila Williams, who wrote the libretto, and composer William Menefield, assistant professor of jazz studies at the University of Iowa School of Music. The opera is making its Iowa debut on Friday and Saturday at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City, and this is a co-production of the University of Iowa School of Music, Performing Arts Production Unit, and Hancher Auditorium. And both Sheila Williams and William Menefield are with me now. Sheila, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. And William, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us. Really appreciate you.
And Sheila, I know this story goes back, to 2018. How did this opera come about?
Well, the Cincinnati Opera wanted to commission a work to commemorate the 100th year of women's suffrage. And they wanted to focus on young women growing up in contemporary society. So what we did was collaborate with two local organizations, Music Resource Center and Wordplay, with five young women from each. And I sat down with them and listened to their stories about their lives, their experiences, the things they liked, the things they didn't, and the challenges of being a young woman in our society, and some of the great things that happen and some of the not so great things that happen. And then I took all of that and used it as inspiration to create Fierce.
And Sheila, you are a novelist. This was your first
yes.
opera. How
yes.
did that even happen?
Well, they approached me and asked if I would be interested. And of course, I went to the dictionary immediately to look up what a libretto was. I loved opera, but I didn't know the lingo yet. I decided it was something I had to put my hat in the ring because I thought, you know what? I'd rather say, yes, I'd like to try and not be accepted rather than not take that chance. So, you know, it's storytelling with music, and that appealed to me. So I thought to myself, why not?
All right. And so a libretto, that is the text of an opera. So were you writing the lyrics that ended up becoming part of the music?
That's correct. I write the words, and Dr. Menefield does the music.
All right. And William, how did you get involved in this?
Well, I was approached by the Cincinnati Opera. We already had a relationship. Tracy Wilson, who works at the Cincinnati Opera, produces a event for them every year called Opera Goes to Church. It started back in 2006, and I played on the first one, and I played on a few of those. So my relationship with them began back then. Also, Cincinnati's my hometown. So just from being a performer around the city, we already knew a lot of the same people and et cetera and so forth. So they approached me about composing. for a new commission.
Had you ever composed for an opera before?
This was my first opera as well.
First for both of you.
Yes.
Indeed. I mean, I had a lot of experience writing for voice already, having written art songs and choral pieces and things of that nature. I also had quite a bit of experience in theater from my time as a student at the School for Creative and Performing Arts, which is the high school I graduated from. Just needed to figure out a way to put all of those together, and this was the opportunity. It's really a treat. I met Sheila as a result of this project. She has become a great friend and was an awesome collaborator. And it was really great that we got to write our first opera together, because we were learning how to work together, but we were also learning how to write an opera and all of the things that go with that. So we really just developed a great relationship as collaborators, creators, and also now I'm pleased to be able to call her a friend.
So Sheila kind of broke this down into four different characters that the opera features, and you decided that each of those characters should have her own aria, right? So tell me a little bit about this process.
Absolutely. So when I was trying to figure out where to start, because I'm like, I'm getting ready to write a whole bunch of music, where do I start? Well, one of the things that was important to me was that the audience had tunes, had songs that they could identify as being songs, which is really all an aria is. It's a signature piece for a vocalist in an opera. So I thought that would be the best place to start. We have four main characters, so let's identify four places in Sheila's libretto that seem like signature aria places. So I started with those four. I also felt like that would be a good plan because it would give the piece some kind of musical identity, at least for the four main characters, and that would inform how I approached the rest of the opera musically. Really glad that I was able to start like that. Oh, one of the other reasons was that I knew that we would have four pieces that would be easy to use as excerpts when that became necessary. So there was a lot of thought that went into that process. It turned out to be something that worked really well.
Well, and Sheila, maybe you can help me with more definitions. I mean, when William's talking about writing a song for each of these women to tell their story, what makes this an opera and not a musical?
Oh, that's a good question. That's, I'm not really sure what the definition should be, because they are both stories told with music. So when I'm writing a novel, of course, nobody's singing, and I'm writing it alone. With this, I have to think in terms of telling the story through the words, and keeping in my head that at some point the words I'm writing will be set to music. So it's almost opera is musical theater. Musical theater in many ways is an opera. So I don't know. Sometimes I think those terms can be used interchangeably.
And William, you've described this a little bit as genre salad. So I think a lot of people, when they hear opera, they have an idea of what the music might sound like, and they're wrong in this case, right?
they couldn't be more wrong in this case. So I think to answer or respond to that, Charity, I think what I will say is there, just to go back to something you were just talking about the difference between opera and musical theater, with musical theater being... yet we identify it as its own thing, but it evolved from opera. That's where it came from. Of course, musical theater has a lot more spoken text than opera does. Opera is thought as being sung throughout. Well, that's what makes this an opera. It's sung throughout. However, I know that because opera started in Italy, it came from the so-called classical music genre, which, of course, there are all kinds of different classical music. There are parts of this opera that sound like that, but then there are parts that sound like hip hop and Afro-Cuban and rock and jazz and soul and all these other genres of music. And that was important to me because that's how I grew up. That is exactly the kind of musician that I am. I have experience performing all of these. I grew up listening to them. We would dance to them. All in one day. My mother was a music teacher, a vocalist and violinist. My dad is a saxophonist. So just had music, all kinds of different music all the time. And when I read Sheila's libretto, I said, I'm going to let her libretto tell me what music is necessary. And out came all these different styles and genres. So I just refer to it as genre salad.
Wow. So, all right, this debuted a couple of years ago in Cincinnati, rave reviews, and, you know, so many really wonderful things have been said about it. Sheila, give me a kind of a sense for the feeling that you're hoping to evoke with the work. What do you want the audience to experience and take away from it?
I want the audience to, first off, I want them to enjoy the music, to enjoy the experience. I hope that they laugh sometimes. I hope that there's a tear in their eye perhaps sometimes. I also want them to time travel a little bit with this piece, because this piece is about young people between the ages of 13 and 18, and everyone who will be sitting in that seat, if they aren't a young person at the moment they're there, they will have lived as a teenager and remember what those days were like and what some of those experiences were like, the uncertainties, parental expectations, having fun with friends, all of those experiences. I want everyone to be able to relate from their heart with the music and the words and the characters of Fierce.
Tell me a little bit about some of the topics. I guess when I talk about teenage girls trying to find their identity and purpose and facing all of the challenges of today, some things spring to mind. But give me an idea of some of the topics that you tackle, Sheila.
Well, Rumor is a character who is dealing with, she's a character who's in love with being in love, but she has had a friend who took their own life, and she is dealing with grief and the idea of life moving forward. Morgan is juggling parental expectations. She has one dream, but her parents have another dream for her. Vesta is the youngest character, and she is trying to cope in a home environment that is very chaotic and in some cases rather violent. And then Naomi is the it girl. She is the most popular girl in school. She's the most fashionable, and she is also in many ways very vulnerable, because her great exterior masks a very soft and vulnerable interior. So she's an extrovert, definitely an extrovert on the outside, but she's very much an introvert on the inside.
And William, this production at the University of Iowa, I mean, not only did you compose this, but now you're leading this production effort, and it's starring University of Iowa students, musicians, dancers. Tell me a little bit about all of the different parts that are coming together to make this happen.
Absolutely. This is really special for me in a lot of ways, because this is my directorial debut. I didn't imagine that that's where this project will be headed when we first started, but it's really a treat. I really wanted to make sure that as many students were involved as possible, since we are producing it here at the University of Iowa. So that was something that I shared with both Andre Perry, who's the director of Hancher, and Tammy Walker, who's the director of the School of Music. So the orchestra pit, students, the students on stage, and many students are involved backstage as well. So it's an opportunity to see the vision that Sheila and I had at the beginning really come to life, because I'm stage directing, so I get to do things a little differently this time. So it's really a great opportunity.
So something that is unique about that, too, is you are putting on this opera about teenagers. And everyone involved, basically, in the production either is one or just was one a few minutes ago, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really a treat to see them blossom as they connect more to the story. And candidly, as they continue to learn. I mean, after all, this is a university. This is a setting that is built for them to prepare for careers as professionals. So there's a lot of teaching involved in the stage directing process and the process of being a composer who's teaching the music. So it's been a treat to see them grow as musicians, but also to connect to the story more and more as we have gotten more comfortable with the blocking and comfortable with the music and comfortable with the set and all these different things. They've really been opening up to it, and it's been a real treat.
So has this been in the works since the beginning of the semester? Is that when you started putting the pieces together? I can imagine this has been a really intense process.
Oh, yes. Yes, it has been. Your imagination is correct. It's been intense. I have had to continue to be a professor, so my course load did not lighten as a result. But so we started rehearsing in the second week of the semester, which was intentional because I wanted to make sure the students had enough time to absorb things without feeling rushed. But it started last summer. I mean, first meeting with Margaret, our costume and set designer, was over the summer, and Brian, our lighting designer, that was over the summer. So these things have been happening for a very long time now. So I wish that we had documented everything. I would love for people to see more of that creative process, because there's so much that goes into putting on a production like this. And I can't say enough about the amazing production staff over at Hancher. They are absolutely brilliant people, and they have been a joy to work with.
Well, I can just imagine that this is an extraordinary experience for all of the students involved. And I know that both of you took some inspiration from Rent when you were creating this show, but we're also living in a Barbie moment, and reading a little bit about that made me think that maybe your students might be connecting on that level as well. What do you think, William?
Well, I'll tell you what, the Rent story is one for the ages, because we never had that conversation, Sheila and I, but we were both thinking the same thing. I called Sheila and said, Sheila, our piece isn't done, because we have a closing scene and it didn't feel done. I said, we need a finale. And I said, Sheila, I'm inspired by the Seasons of Love from Rent. What do you think? She took a picture of a note that she had written down that literally said Rent, circled with a question mark. And we had not talked about it.
Wow.
It was mind blowing. So we were on the same page. And that's ultimately what inspired us to go ahead and write that finale. So
Wow. So you guys almost were meant to be together. Sheila, do you feel like there's more opera in your future?
I hope so. It was a challenging process, but it was definitely a great one. So I could do it again. Yes, definitely.
Sheila Williams, don't get on the radio and start being all coy.
Dr. Renifield might have another opinion.
She has been not so subtly nudging me into the direction of us doing another opera.
Nice.
So she's trying to turn it down a couple of notches today for some reason.
Well, thank you both for talking with me today, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for
having us.
I've been talking with Sheila Williams. She is a novelist who wrote the libretto for the opera Fierce. And William Menifield. He is the composer of this opera, assistant professor of jazz studies at the University of Iowa School of Music, and the lead producer on this new production at the University of Iowa. Fierce will debut on Friday and Saturday at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City, and is a co-production of the University of Iowa School of Music, Performing Arts Production Unit, and Hancher Auditorium. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.